B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
For the Love of Metal is Dee Snider's latest album. We talk all about it in front of a live audience at Astronomicon in Sterling Heights, Michigan on February 8th. We talk about how the record came about, working with Jamie Joshua, putting his career in Jamie's hands, and whether or not that was a true statement.
Absolutely.
He goes into more detail about that during the interview. We talked about the 90s and the music scene then.
Yeah, and it just sort of felt like there was not a place for me. You know, the music scene was changing dramatically.
Dee fought his battles, especially in the first part of the decade.
I had a year where I had $0 income. 91 or 92, $0 on my tax return.
Which legendary band did Dee say this about?
And I turned to my bass player and go, you know, these guys got a lot of heart, but they're never going to go anywhere.
And that's just for starters. In front of a live audience, it's Talkin' Rock with Dee Snider.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Ah, yes, thank you so much for checking out Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. I do appreciate it. Another great one on tap for you today with the legendary Dee Snider. We'll get into what went into this podcast coming up here in just a second. Real fast, want to plug BPodStudios.com. That's our Beasley Media Group hub as far as podcasts are concerned. If you like this one, there's some other music podcasts on there, wrestling, sports, even some of the radio shows. Stephen Preston from Philadelphia, Dave and Chuck from right here in Detroit. So a lot of really cool stuff that you can check out as you're out there surfing the World Wide Web. So Astronomicon is this, it's a Comic-Con hosted by the guys from the band Twisted. I talked with Madrox. I talked with Monoxide within the last couple months. Both of them plug in Astronomicon, which once again will be back again for its third year next year in 2019. I want to say the dates are like February 7th through the 9th, something along those lines. But Jamie was super excited to find out the day they had gotten Dee Snider to come by. And somewhere along the line, they asked me if I would host his Q&A panel. And I'll tell you what, man, I've known Dee for many, many, many years. But it was really cool to be up there on stage with him for the better part of 50 minutes, talking about his career, talking about the new stuff he's doing, the PMRC, even a Christmas song he wrote for a very, very popular artist, which we'll get into coming up near the end. But this was a really cool interview. And as he talks about, Fridays at these Comic Cons are a little bit lighter as far as people go. There was probably between 70 and 80 people in this room just listening to Dee. And what happened was a lot of them asked questions. Now, I didn't get a chance to like really say, hey, this is being taped for a podcast and the whole thing. So unfortunately, I had to take their questions out and kind of ask them myself. So you'll hear me pop in from time to time and kind of ask the fans questions just because I think legally I can't use their voice. But without any further ado, because this is a really cool listen, I want to get into it right now. It's Dee Snider on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown. The first question was, what were his thoughts on Astronomicon?
My first impression are Friday's awesome. The energy's awesome. The, I know it's a lot of juggalo blood here, so it's good. And, you know, and people know how to have a good time. So usually Fridays at these cons, you know or you don't know, tend to be slower. People don't show up on Friday. But you guys are here for the party, so it's great.
Yeah, cool. Well, in case you guys don't know, Dee's got a new record out. It's called For the Love of Metal. And I just started listening to it this week because I told him I hadn't got the vinyl copy of it yet. It's so killer. And we'll talk about that for a second here. But one of the first things it reminded me of was your old days in Widowmaker. That's kind of one of the first impressions I got. What do you think?
That's kind of interesting. It's much heavier than Twisted was. And not Twisted. The first Twisted. Than Twisted was. And people are kind of confused by that. But I joined Twisted Sister, and they were a glitter rock. Glitter is like glam rock, early 70s, Bowie, T-Rex, Alice Cooper, that kind of stuff. And so when I joined them, I liked that stuff, but I was a metalhead, so I brought my metal influences, and we created what became sort of what they call hair metal, glam rock. But now that I'm solo, Twisted retired 2 years ago. Twisted, not Twisted. So now I'm doing what I want to do, and what I want to do is fucking metal, hardcore influenced metal. So And the new album went to number 20 on the Billboard charts. I haven't been on the charts in 35 years. And it's been one of the top metal albums in the world since it came out. So I'm happy with the reaction. I hope you people have heard it, are happy with it. And if you haven't heard it, you older fans, I don't like them older, original. OG fans, they're loving it because there's enough of that Under the Blade, Widowmaker in there. But Jamie Josta produced it, and you know, Mark Morton from Lamb of God came in and worked on it, and you know, Howard Jones from Killswitch Engage, and it's, I mean, so many, and people from All the Remains, and all these bands came in and worked on the record, so it has a fresher sound. So, which would you agree?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So people both young and old alike are liking the record, so it's cool.
Now, like you just mentioned, Jamie Josta. So, were you planning on recording anything, and before he came to you, or were you just going to kind of just see where life took you?
We built a house on a beach in Belize, and I was retiring, and Josta challenged me on his podcast, and he said, challenge you to do a true metal record. And I said, you know, I love to, but I don't want to go back to the future. You know, that's when I was with Twisted Sister, and we were reunited. They kept wanting to do a new album, and I said, nobody wants to hear new music from an old band. They want you to do old-sounding music, and nobody is interested in hearing it, quite honestly. Any old band says these words, for some fucking reason, all you motherfuckers have to piss. These are the words. Now, no one will run out and go piss, because I'm not doing it, all right? These are the words. This one's off the new record. Hey, man, I gotta take a picture. It's like, it triggers this, or else you need a beer. I mean, I've seen every band in the world deals with it, and you fuckers don't think we can see. We're on stage. We're above you. We can see everybody leaving the room. It's like, you work on a new... So I said, fuck it, I'm not doing it, you know? But Josta said, no, man, I love that. We didn't have a deal or nothing. We just did it out of our own pockets in our spare time. And he just said, no, let's work together. Everybody's going to want to work with you on this record. And I think we'll make something that's really cool and people are going to be want to hear. And he was right, you know, so I'm not retired.
Now, one of the first things I saw when I picked up the album was he like produced it and he wrote a lot of the songs and stuff. Did you ever think that you were like leaving your career in his hands?
Absolutely. I mean, I said, look, I don't want to, I'm like brutally honest, you know, I'm that guy. I said, I had stopped writing in 96 after the second Widowmaker record because I just felt like I wasn't being true. I felt like I was, instead of writing from the heart, I was listening to what was going on and trying to imitate it. And that's not honest, you know, and that's why I feel the records weren't working. You know, people, I'm not saying, you know, I'm proud of the Widowmaker stuff, but still, the fact is I was analyzing the newer sound and trying to sound newer. So Joss, I said, I don't know what to do, so I'm putting myself in your hands. And Joss is really talented, really smart, and really fucking dedicated to metal, to hardcore. He's, you know, and so he said, like, you know, put your trust in me. I said, all right, dude. So like I said, we had no record deal. We went in the studio, but the minute we started recording, both of us, I'm on one side of the glass and I'm going, fucked, this works. And they're on the other side of the glass going, fuck, this works. Steve's fucking getting into it. So it just sort of gelled. And then, like I said, everybody started coming out of the woodwork to write on the record and be a part of it. It was just really cool.
Yeah, it's interesting because you were in Twisted Sister. Then when that went away, you started Widowmaker. And for those that don't know, that was a band with Al Petrelli and whatnot. And that was in a time when music was really changing.
Yeah.
In the early 90s.
Yeah, and it just sort of felt like there was not a place for me. You know, the music scene was changing dramatically, and I was feeling like, okay, I had my moment, step the fuck aside. And I'm down, you know, and I'm fine with that. And I went into radio then and television and did movies you know, I've been on Broadwaves and all sorts of crazy shit. But now Joss is like, no, dude, you're iconic, and we need Dee Snider's voice. We need that voice of anger, that voice of frustration, that voice to speak for everybody who are just fucking pissed off at the world. Somebody's got to represent. And believe me, I know there's a lot of people representing Twisted and all the guys, but you've got a, he says, you got a unique voice and people still want to hear it. So I think, fortunately, has been working out, you know, and he'd seen me live, and, you know, I'm not one of those, I'm not going to mention Vince Neil's name, but...
Especially on his birthday.
It's his birthday. I'm not mentioning his name. I'm fucking 64, okay? So don't tell me how tough it is to get up there and, you know, and rock. Hey. So, but anyway, you know, I've always stayed in shape, and my heart's here, but now I've got the album to fucking go with how I feel inside.
Hey, let's go back real fast, because one of the coolest documentaries I saw in the past few years was We Are Twisted Effin' Sister, you know what I'm saying? Talk about that and how that came about.
Some documentarian, free, has anybody seen the documentary We Are Twisted Fucking Sister? 2573 Okay. You don't got to be a hardcore fan to like this documentary. And what happened was this documentary producer heard of that fact that Twisted Sister, we were together for 10 years before the world discovered us, before MTV, before that We're Not Going to Take It moment. 10 fucking years. And we had this regional, we were really popular regionally, but we just couldn't
get it. It was in Long Island, right?
Long Island, New Jersey, Connecticut. It was a tri-state thing. We'd play for 1,000 to 4,000 people a night, five nights a week, without a record deal. Just, we were just this, we had bodyguards. It was crazy. We were just locally famous. Kind of what Bob Seger was like that at some point. When he first started out, huge in the Detroit area, but you could, you know, any place else, you just playing up like a little bar. So there's these artists who are like that. Anyway, he heard our story, and he said, this is like a Rocky story. This is like the band that wouldn't give up, and we got knocked down so many times, and we just refused to die. And we finally won. So he made this documentary called We Are Twisted Fucking Sister, and it's done really well. It's on Netflix and Amazon and everything. So you should check it out. If you're looking for some inspiration, if you're feeling like, man, how can I do this one more fucking day, go watch us five assholes doing it for 10 fucking years. And you go, oh, shit, that's nothing. I got nothing on them.
Yeah, you guys really had your share of downs before your ups in the 80s. Yeah. So you just mentioned Bob Seger and stuff. I know you talked to Wayne Kramer recently. Detroit, of course, is heavy as far as music goes, the musical past. What kind of stuff influences you from Detroit?
Well, look, Alice. And I know he's by way of Arizona, but he's originally from Detroit, and they broke out of here. Alice Cooper, Iggy Pop, MC5. You know, you got these bands. But let me tell you fucking Wayne Kramer story. This is awesome. So I finally meet Wayne, and we get sit down. We go have breakfast together, you know. And so we're talking, and you know, you have a opportunity to meet one of your heroes and just sit down and just having pancakes and coffee and just, like, talking about everything. It was just an awesome moment. So now you guys, how many people are aware of the history of the MC5? Anybody? A lot of young people here. Okay, these motherfuckers were literally revolutionaries, right? They came out of the hippie era, but you guys don't do hippie well. They, like, you know, they were the hippie era, but, like, with guns and shit, okay? And they, seriously, you guys don't do hippie well in the Midwest. It's like, fuck that, you know? And so they formed the White Panthers, and it wasn't like a KKK thing. It was, like, in solidarity with the Black Panthers. So they're investigated by the FBI, and they're, and the CIA, and everybody's up their ass, and there's rumors that they tried to blow up the federal building here in town. This is a rock band in their spare time. I know in Norway they're burning down churches, but this is a rock band out of Detroit who in his spare time is trying to blow up federal buildings. That's metal as fuck right there. So all right, now this is fucking 50 years ago. So I'm leaving Wayne. We walk out to our cars. I said, listen, before I go, man, I just want to know, did you guys blow up the building? And Wayne just goes dead on me. All right, so I'm going to go. It's an empty parking lot. It's 50 years later. Statute of limitations has got to be over. And he's still fucking like, yeah, I'm going to go. So I think they tried to blow up the federal building.
Now, you became friends with him because didn't you, you tweeted something about him, right?
Yeah, I'm in this really cool position, you know, when you're, you know, when you get to be famous and you get to meet your heroes and become friends with your heroes. And, you know, and if you, and if it's a new band, like there's a band called Monster Truck out of Canada. I don't know if anybody's heard them. Real retro, Lynyrd Skynyrd meets Deep Purple in Alice in Chains' backyard. I mean, they just get it and they fucking rock and it's awesome. And now when that happens, I just contact the record label, get the guy's phone number and call him up. Hey, John, it's Dee Snider. And they're like, the Dee Snider? I'm like, yeah, man, I love your band. I got a T-shirt and everything. So I just call him up and I get to meet him. And with some, you know, I take advantage of that. When the opportunity, I saw Wayne on, you know, on Twitter, and I just like, boom, I zoom in there. I said, dude, I love the MC5. And then, you know, I get to connect and be friends. So it's cool that I get to do that. I mean, I get to friends with Robert Plant, Alice Cooper. And the fact of the matter is, I'll sit there hanging with these guys, and every now and then it hits me that I literally had a Robert Plant poster hanging over my bed. Over my fucking bed. Like, right at the top of the headboard, and I kind of bow down before it, and now I'm, like, hanging with the dude. So I never forget that because, you know, I mean, fan first, rock star second, you know?
How many of you guys had a Dee Snider Twisted Sister poster above your... We got a couple here. There you go.
The OGs. The OGs. The OGs.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't say that. Original gangsters. Yeah.
So you're talking about social media and stuff and meeting some of your heroes and stuff, but what do you think about social media in 2019 where the fans can interact with you as well?
You know, I've been active on social media now for a while, and it's an interesting thing. It's definitely brings you closer. It connects you with them, and they're more connected with you. And there's so many people who come up to me and say, "Hey, I'm, you know, I'm Grease Monkey on Twitter," or whatever. Somewhere, you're a Grease Monkey. God, I expect you to be taller.
I've heard that before too.
But you know, it's interesting because one thing that's cool, you can like get the word out more directly. You know, you're getting to make statements right, you know, immediately to the people, and then the press is picking up on the statements you're making, but they're your statements, you know, and you know, so we can't say somebody misquoted you because they're literally taking your tweet out. It's what you wrote. So it's a great opportunity to have your voice heard, and it's weird sometimes how things react. You know, how many people here are on Twitter? Are you on Twitter? Okay. So isn't it weird what reacts or doesn't react? Is it the same for you guys as me? Like, I'll, like, you know, share my, like, innermost things. And then one day I write, I'm just sitting at fucking breakfast. I go, I love pancakes. It was my biggest tweet. It was like thousands and thousands. And I was like, what the fuck? I told you about the birth of my first child last week. It was like 50 people said, I like it. And now I'm saying, I like pancakes. And everybody, do you like pancakes? They're like, what? I like pancakes too. What the fuck is that? But then I just had a blow up on Twitter.
The NFL one, right?
The NFL. Yeah. And again, it was just like, I was just sitting there and going, what the, hey, NFL, what's the biggest, the songs you play at every game are Welcome to the Jungle, you know, Come on, Feel the Noise, We're Not Gonna Take It, Thunderstruck. You know, I run down a list. I go, not one of those bands has played the halftime show. What's up with that? Fucking 30,000 retweets. I mean, to talk, people are talking about it on radio, like, you know, and actually it just sort of hit me. Why is the pump up music is all this great shit? The song, I went and studied it, and Billboard actually did the 100 most popular rock and jock, not really, sports anthems. By the way, I thought I want to rock it. We're not going to take it. We're on it. They didn't make the top 100, so much to my chagrin. But they, I looked at the list, and only two of the bands whose music is played at every fucking sporting event actually played the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, they're hiring bands like Coldplay. What the fuck is that supposed to do? And I just, I'm going to be posting an open letter to Roger Goodell saying the object, the idea of the halftime show is to continue the energy and then bring it to the second half, not squash the energy and suck all the fucking air out of the room, Maroon 5.
Yeah, that was a terrible
Holy fuck.
Man.
But he took his shirt off.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just so... people and as people react to that, you know, so it's so social media is awesome like that where you can share something and people can share it with each other. So it's
yeah,
cool.
You know what social media is like? Did you ever you've seen the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, right?
And so love that movie, except it doesn't hold up. None of that shit works anymore.
Planes, well, here's the thing. Remember when they're going on the bus and they're singing songs and stuff, and then John Candy says to Steve Martin, "Sing a song." And he starts singing a song and no one follows along. And then John Candy starts singing the Flintstones and everyone follows along. That's what the internet's like.
Exactly, and that's why we need a Flintstones reunion halftime next Super Bowl.
That's right. Get the Flintstones out.
Yabba dabba fucking do. Get them out there.
Hey, Chuck is out there and he's got a microphone. So if you guys have a question, we'll get Chuck here in just a second. Real fast, just want to talk about a few more things here with D. So you guys think of your questions here.
I want to talk about something. All right. We got any juggalos here? Yeah. Okay. You do know I'm the only motherfucking celebrity that stood up for Insane Clown Posse with all that bullshit. The only one who typed the video. I couldn't believe my peers when the guys told me, they contacted me and said, "Will you say something about the way we're being treated? Is this fucking censorship?" And they said, "Nobody else will stand up." And I felt like I was back in the 80s when I went to Washington to stand up to fight censorship. Nobody else stepped forward. Nobody wanted to fucking get involved. That's bullshit. Censorship is censorship. Whether you like the posse or not, it's fucking censorship. You got to fight it. You're either for censorship or against it. I'm fucking against it. Just words. So.
Hey, now, when they started slapping those parental guidance stickers on your records and your record sales started going up, how'd that feel?
You know what? That's actually an urban legend that sales went up. Everybody says that. Wrong. Okay. The reason I was against those stickers is I saw what they could be used for. I was afraid that they would use to segregate material, and they were. When the stickers happened, stores that were conservative wouldn't carry the records. They wouldn't shelve them. So it wasn't a matter of making parents aware. If you can't get the record, what, you know, that's the problem. So people say, "Oh, my sales went." No, they did not go up. There were stores that stopped carrying. And it got even worse. Best Buy and Walmart, they were demanding censored versions of records that you didn't know were censored. So the Strangeland soundtrack, my movie Strangeland, there was a Kid Rock song on there, thank you. But there was a Kid Rock song on there called "Fuck Off." And
that was not on his record, yeah.
Yeah, when I went to Best Buy, it had been removed. And it didn't say censored version, edited version. They just had a special issue made. The record companies made it because they wouldn't, they're a big chain. They wouldn't make to carry the record unless they removed all the profanity from the record. So that's fucked up.
Yeah.
And that's when censorship goes too far.
Yeah, I think I listened to Kid Rock's Devil Without a Cause for 6 months before I realized there was two songs missing on that record.
Yeah, and it's fucked up because, you know, when I was in Washington and they were saying, well, they're concerned about 12-year-olds. Well, so, you know, a 16-year-old, an 18-year-old, a 20-year-old can't go into Walmart and buy an album and not have to worry about songs being removed or censored like you did, you know? Yeah. So it was fucked up.
Here's where we took a question from the crowd. The question was, does he think that testifying before Congress against the PMRC actually helped or hindered his cause?
Okay, assuming people don't know what happened. In the 80s, they wanted to sticker the records. That's that Warner program. And so they asked me if I would come and testify before a Senate hearing, along with Frank Zappa and John Denver, of all people, and in defense of rock and roll. I was one of the bands that was being censored. We're not going to take it. It was on the Filthy 15 for being violent. It was the stupidest fucking thing. So I thought I was carrying the torch. When they asked me, carrying the flag, man, into battle, lead the fucking way. But when I got there, A, the record company had already agreed to a sticker. When Frank and I, we hadn't even opened our mouths and we found out that the RIAA, the recording industry, who have now changed their name, by the way, because, you know, they're scum. Anyway, they had already agreed to the sticker. So Frank and I are like, what are we doing here? I mean, if they've already given up. And then afterwards, the truth of the matter was the other bands, just like I said about ICP and people speaking out against censorship of any kind, that way people just lay low. Everybody else in the industry just shut their mouths. I'm talking about all my peers. Nobody stood up. Nobody said, yeah, we're with D, not one other band, okay? Dead Kennedys, credit where credit's due, Jello Biafra, you know, he did speak out. But for the most part, they did not. I went home, and to my phones being tapped, to my mail being checked, to my packages being checked, I was suddenly, because I fucking embarrassed those motherfuckers, I did. But I was suddenly public enemy number one, and it was the aftermath was not cool. So, I mean, but as the years have gone by, it's become this sort of thing, legendary, cool thing, and I did the right thing. So that's all I care about. I stood up when someone needed to stand up. If nobody else stood up, just like with ICP, I'm standing up. I'm not looking around going, well, who else is saying something? You either against censorship or you're not against censorship. So,
this might be kind of a silly question, but in kind of the same type of thing, do you kind of feel like you kind of knew where Lars was coming from with the Napster thing? Because he was kind of up there by himself as well.
I totally understood. I mean, people were villainizing, you know, Metallica. And first of all, you know, we toured together in the early days. Those motherfuckers earned every fucking dollar they made. They didn't give an inch. Until the, you know, Alternica record. But other than that, which I thought was a great record, but then they gave an inch. But up till that point, they just fought hard. And I remember, this is a true story. So we're on tour with Metallica, and we're in Holland, and I'm standing outside the stage, and I'm watching them doing their set. And I turn to my bass player, I go, you know, these guys got a lot of heart, but they're never going to go anywhere. Like I said, I'm brutally honest. I said that out fucking loud. What an asshole. But I didn't mean it like against them. I just said, they're so heavy. But they made people, you know, just accept how heavy they were, you know, and that's the great thing about Metallica. But with Lars and the Napster thing, he didn't. Look, when I explain people my feelings about that the sampling that was going on, and now it's just gone, it's out of control. But I said, look, it's like you go into a fruit stand and you're thinking about buying some strawberries or some grapes. Most fruit stands that I've been to, and when I say fruit, I don't mean fruit, I mean like actual fruit, okay? But most fruit stands, they'll say, taste one, and they'll let you taste a strawberry, and they'll let you taste a grape, and you go, oh, you know what, they're not ripe yet. And you walk away. Or you say, wow, I really like those. At that point, you don't steal the grapes or the strawberries. You pay for the strawberries. So to me, sampling was a great thing. It goes back to the 50s when people used to go into record shops, and this is true, and they would get to put on the record with a pair of headphones and listen to the music. So you listen and they go, I like this. And you pay it, or, man, this sucks, and you don't buy it. That's cool. That's fine. So Lars just, you know, well, Lars is Lars. And he just, I don't think he explained it right, but he got crucified.
But I guess the question is, you could appreciate where he was coming from.
I totally could appreciate it. You're standing out there with your dick in your hand.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt like. Well, actually, my dick was in both hands. It was. No, I don't want to brag, but...
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
Another fan in attendance asked what his favorite part about playing Captain Howdy in his movie Strangeland was.
My favorite part of playing Captain Howdy in Strangeland. Has anybody seen Strangeland? Oh. I'm glad. No, seriously. My favorite part... That was the worst part. That was the part. I mean, I had ulcers playing, like trying to be that, like that nebbishy. That was the worst part. You know, this is the truth. I got to tell you. When I wrote that movie, I was a father of three children. I was the cop in my head. It was what I would do if someone did that to my kids. That was the inspiration for the songs that inspired that. And I was like, I'd get that motherfucker, whatever it took. So, but I don't have the rugged good looks to be the cop, so I had to be the scary bad guy. So I really didn't identify with Captain Howdy, but I certainly did a good job of making believe. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, like, yeah, I mean, that, and I have girls, and you may be one of them, and a girl just walked up to the table and said, I love Captain Howdy. And I said, you are fucked up. Do not come to my room. Stay away from me. Because you're not supposed to like that guy. I was trying to make him as fucking heinous as possible. And yet there's still people going, he's hot.
Well, there's people that write, you know, all sorts of letters to, like, you know, convicted serial killers in jail. You know how it goes.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, but I loved. I'll tell you one more Strangeland story. So, I wrote the movie, and you know, and I co-produced it, and getting to make it, and so there's one scene. There was this, where, you know, where in the middle of the movie, where the father finds his daughter in the cage. He comes into Howdy's lair, and he shoots Howdy, and Howdy's face down, laying on the ground. He's just been shot. Gage is trying to get his daughter out of the cage. So we're filming a scene. There's like 50 extras in the room and candles, and everybody's nude and mouths are sewn shut, and it's fucking, the setup was crazy. And they, okay, and action, and I start laughing. And they're like, cut, D, what's going on? I'm on the ground, face down, laughing. And I said, I just remembered sitting in my basement writing this scene. He lays face down on the ground. Gage, I'm writing the scene, and here it was coming to fucking life. And I just started laughing at the excitement of it, but it wasn't a funny scene.
Yeah, I think I saw that movie in the theater when it first
Although
came
Linda
out.
Cardellini apparently accidentally saw my balls. She said, Linda Cardellini's actress has become, she was Genevieve. And when I fell on the ground, I was wearing a loincloth. She's in the cage with her mouth sewn shut, and somehow she managed to go, I see your balls. I think I was laughing about that too, for sure.
Now, you've really like reinvented yourself with movies and music and the whole thing. Like you said, you were doing voiceovers. You've done a bunch of those as well.
Yeah.
What was the time when you were like, if I remember correctly, you were working in an office? What year was that?
Well, you know, I mean, by 1992, I had lost all the millions of dollars. I didn't lose it. I knew where it was, just some other people were using the money. I no longer had possession of it. I knew where it went. And I didn't do drugs, and I didn't drink, and I wasn't one of those people who said, my manager controlled everything. No, I controlled fucking everything. I fucking just blew it. And people say, how do you lose that much money? And I explain, it's very simple. It takes a tremendous ego, and that's not a joke, to convince yourself that against all odds, I'm going to make it. When you make it, and then it starts to come apart, that same ego that got you there won't let you believe that it's falling apart. So instead of going, oh, wow, you know, I better, like, you know, downscale everything, sell a few cars and a boat or two, and get us, you know, instead of doing that, you go, oh, the next tour, the next album. And eventually you just start borrowing against your future income, and eventually they cut you off. And eventually you got, I had a year where I had $0 income. 91 or 92, $0 on my tax return. Okay. And I was literally riding a bicycle to a desk job, answering phones for $200 cash a week because I had three kids and I was married. And the choice at that point is either do this or you fucking do something. And a woman does something. You know, you stand up and you just pick yourself up and you try. And I remember sitting in that office and people would walk in. This is 92. and they'd see Dee Snider answering the phone. They go, "Hey, aren't you Dee Snider?" And I would lie because I was so embarrassed. And the people believed the lie because who would think Dee Snider would be on the phone at the desk? That guy I saw on MTV. So, you know, I mean, you know, I'm proud that I pulled out of it and came back from it and have had success again in so many things. But it's important that I like to share that story because people need to know that we all fall down. We all fuck up. And it's about how, you know, they still say it's not how many times you get knocked down. It's how many times you get back up and keep moving forward. And that's just remember that, you know, I would say as long as you're healthy enough to get out and try again. Thank you. You know, I'll keep going.
This fan wanted to know the inspiration for some of Captain Howdy's lines because they were so deep.
Well, no, it's some deep shit. No, I really, you know, got into the body mod community and I really studied and I really read and I really spent time within the community to understand the philosophy. And it's a, and it is a belief system, you know, a deep belief system. In Captain Howdy's case, it was a pile of shit. He was using the belief system to cover up his desire to hurt people and for people to suffer at his hands. That's not what body modification is about. It's voluntary. You go in and you get pierced. You do a flesh hook hanging. You do some recreational piercing. But it's a choice, not someone doing it against your will. So I really got in there and studied. I'll tell you a story about my studies. So I go to a top piercing parlor. And I'm looking around at, you know, they had all sorts of magazines and books in them. And one of the piercers recognizes me and he says, "Hey, Deep, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm writing this movie, you know, it's characters deep in this piercing world." And he goes, "I'm about to do a piercing. You want to come inside and watch?" So I was like, "That'd be cool, you know, right? Like, it's like keep going for a ride along with a cop, like actually seeing how it happens." So he says to the guy and the girl, "Do you mind if Dee comes in and watches?" And they go, "No, that's cool. Come on inside." So the guy gets in, and Keith Alexander, his name was, played with a band called Carnivore, played with me in SMFs as well, but he's a top piercer and brander. And he goes, "Okay, drop your pants." And the guy drops down. He goes, "All right." And now he's holding the guy's dick in his hand. All right. So and I said, "Oh, shit, he's piercing his dick." And I said, "Oh, well, fortunately, Keith's a righty and I'm behind him. So I don't got to watch this guy getting his dick pierced." And until Keith goes, "Hey, Dee, why don't you come around the other side so you get a big view of what's going on?" Fuck, I'm going to watch a guy get his dick pierced. Shit. It was an amp lying. All right. So it's going like right through the fucking, right below the head, right through. So Keith comes, this is great. Keith goes, and the guy's girlfriend's there. They're all excited because it's a pleasure piercing. And so Keith's still holding the dick. He's a confident heterosexual sitting there just holding the dick. He goes, "Listen, you know, get ready. A few seconds of pain for a lifetime of pleasure." And the guy goes, "Go for it." Boom, goes through. This guy's eyes go, "Fuck." I'm like, "Oh, shit." So Keith cleans it up and goes, "All right, your dick's going to feel like it was hit with a sledgehammer for the next week or so." And the guy's like, "What happened to a second of hit with a sledgehammer for a week or so?" So stay away from the ampelang. That's the moral of that story. You don't want an ampelang, guys. It's just not fucking
I could have gone all night or probably my whole life without hearing that story.
Yeah, I mean, so go ahead. There's enough few people in this room who are just like sort of with this guy right here. He's like, yeah, it had to be so descriptive.
The topic of censorship was brought up again.
And the weird thing that's going on now, and I'll get to your question, is just that it went from being a right-wing conservative thing. Now that censorship is coming predominantly from the left-wing liberals with all the PC, "You can't say that, you can't say that, you can't say that." That's censorship too. It doesn't matter what your reason behind it, you know, that hurts people's feelings or, you know, that's just fucked up. But censorship is censorship. So your question.
Her question basically was, how did it feel to walk into the Senate and basically give everybody the middle finger?
Well, you mentioned the cutoff T-shirt and the jeans, but you didn't mention they were so tight you could tell I was circumcised.
God, but I love you let them know.
Yeah, but I schooled them. Anyway, I'll tell you what. I look back on that footage, And I see myself walking in that room with my cut-off denim jacket, and I'd put mascara on, and and my snakeskin boots. And I go, holy fuck, kid, how did you walk with balls that big? I mean, I just go, oh, my God. I wonder if I could do that today. And then I go, yeah, I could for sure. So I'm ready to go back anytime. They're still huge. They're huge. But it was, you know, I you know, there was a moment. Again, I'm honest to the point of stupidity. So I walked in. I'm cocky as fuck. I'm slick my dick. You know, I'm like, I'm walking in there, and I got my... Famously, I got my speech that I worked on for 2 weeks folded up like a bad kid's homework in my back pocket. You know, and I get out there, I'm like smoothing it out, trying to make it look better for the teacher. You know, that shit, getting the coffee stain off of it. And then I look up, and there was a second where I, like, oh, shit. Like, the reality of, and there's this bank of cameras and these fucking white-haired old dudes, you know, hi. I got scared and my hand started to shake, and then my voice in my head said, get it together, man. I was screaming at myself, cut that shit out. And I go, okay, let's go. And then but there was a moment, man, with that reality just hit me like a wave, because it was pretty fucking intense situation going on there. But like I said, yeah, I did the right thing. So I tried at least.
Hey, has anybody here ever seen Twisted Sister live?
Yeah!
One person. I love that girl. Woo! OG. OG. There's a few people. Yeah, that's an old thing too.
I was going to say, because a lot of these...
I didn't say that. It's an old thing.
A lot of younger people ask about the movie and about the PMRC, which, of course, lives on the internet for, you know, for the rest of eternity.
You know, it's a weird thing because I've, you know, like, all right, how many people here are aware that I have a radio show on the Riff called House of Hair? So I've been a DJ now for 25 years. House of Hair has been on 22 years. So, I mean, I've seen in my household, my daughter was just born when that show started. And now she's out of college and she's working and looks like Captain Howdy's daughter, actually. Heavily tattooed, pierced, red, screaming hair. She's fantastic. But, you know, so, I mean, it's been like a lifetime. But a lot of people know me as a DJ or from reality TV or from Strangeland. And Twisted Sister is like a very distant thing to a lot, to younger people. So it's interesting.
How many of you guys saw him on The Apprentice? With the president.
With the president.
That means you're qualified now.
I'll tell you this. For what it's worth, I raised $325,000 for the March of Dimes that helps premature babies and babies born with birth defects. So that was good enough reason to do that show.
And don't you do a motorcycle ride every year for charity?
Yeah, I've been doing charity rides. I do a lot of charity work. I always thank Mick Foley as my inspiration. I did zero charity work before I met Mick Foley, and he is one of the most charitable, generous people I've ever met in my life. And he reached out to me one day and said, hey, I'm going to a hospital to see a kid. He's got cancer. He's a fan of yours. Would you come with me to the hospital? And we went there, and I spent, you know, the afternoon with this kid. And it says it in one of Mick's books. He dropped me off my house, and I said, Mick, you changed my life today. And he did. And I started doing charitable work. I've received awards for doing charitable work. Nothing compared to Mick Foley. The shit he does. I mean, give it up for Mick Foley, please. I'm telling you. Beyond, he does many, many public things. He's done the, you know, he has a list from the Cancer Society of children, kids with cancer who are wrestling fans, and he cold calls them in his spare time. No fanfare, no publicity, no Make-A-Wish Foundation, which is a great foundation, and he's done. He just knocks on their fucking doors and says, hey, how you doing? And walks in and hangs out for an afternoon. That's charity at a level I can't even conceive of. So, one more time, Mick Foley, because he's an inspiration to me. He should be to everybody, actually.
I tell you what, we got time for a couple more questions. You guys want Chuck?
I got one.
Oh, go. Chuck,
D,
right there.
D, okay. If you don't mind, could you tell the assembled folk here today about what the magic of Christmas Day is?
Okay. So it's the late 80s. I've been with the same woman 43 years now, Suzette. I met her when she was 15. I was 21. Yikes. Family was mob, threatened to kill me on the first date. It was like meeting the fucking Sopranos, let me tell you. It was fucking heavy. But we've been together forever. So at some point in the late 80s, she asked me to write her a Christmas song. I said, what are you fucking nuts? I'm metal. I don't Christmas song. I don't know why I talk like Stallone at his worst. And she goes, you're a classically trained countertenor, which I actually am. And she goes, you can write me a Christmas song. I go, I can't write a Christmas song. Christmas song is a genre specific. When's the last time you heard a really good new, Anyway, she says, you can do it. So I was doing some writing and divine whatever, a Christmas song just comes flying out of my mouth, and a real Christmas song, not a metal Christmas song, not a rock Christmas song, Christmas song. I can't even sing it right. So for Christmas that year, I hired some session musicians and I hired a woman, and they recorded it, sang it, and I gave it to her as a Christmas present. That was it. It was a gift from my wife. Engineer on the session asked if he could have a copy. Cut to 5 years later, I get a call. Said engineer is now a producer. He goes, are you sitting down? I said, yeah. And I remember 5 years later, this is when I'm riding a bike to fucking a desk job, right? He was sitting down. I go, yeah. He goes, Celine Dion wants to record your wife's Christmas song. So I go, does she know who wrote the song? He says, I haven't told her yet. I said, do not tell her Satan wrote a Christmas song. Just put it on the fucking album. He says, well, she wants to change the title. The title was God Bless Us Everyone. So she wants to call it The Magic of Christmas, God Bless Us Everyone. I said, I don't care if she calls it. This song's a piece of dog shit. Just put it on her fucking Christmas album. Well, that Christmas album is the biggest selling holiday record in history. It's called These Are Special Times. It sold 14 million copies and counting, and we call our house the house Saint Celine built. God bless Saint Celine.
Have you met her?
No. I still don't want to ruin it. I'm afraid she'll retroactively pull it off the record. Say, you wrote it? Give me my money back.
Another fan question was why Dee chose to cover Cry Little Sister.
I had this project called Van Helsing's Curse. It was a gothic Halloween rock orchestra knit to a story, mixed rock and classical, and worked with Al Petrelli, you mentioned earlier, who was with Megadeth, and he's from the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. And so we released the record, and people kept wanting to hear me sing at the show, and it was a Halloween show. And there was no vocals on this thing. It was me narrating the story. I didn't sing. But people kept wanting like an encore. So someone suggested Cry Little Sister. And it's just a great, just spooky, not spooky, I don't know what the word is for it. Just sort of a great vibe to it, you know? And Thou Shalt Not Fear, that was the good kids singing. So we went in and recorded it and added it as to a re-release of the record because it just fit. So I would do that as the encore. So finally, after sitting through me prattling on about some scary thing, I'd come out and sing one song at the end. It was Cry Little Sister. So that was the inspiration. Great song.
If I remember correctly, wasn't one of the songs Tubular Hell or something like that?
Tubular Hell, yeah. A mixture of Tubular Bells and a few other things. It was a great record. We brought the show out here. It was kind of like a Trans-Siberian on steroids, but it just was very expensive to stage, and we just couldn't get it launched, so unfortunately.
So wrapping things up here with you, Dee, and thanks for all the time today. What's coming up in 2019? You got tours, or you got more of these cons? What do you got?
You know, this, I got more cons, of course. This record has reconnected me with not just my audience, with a new audience, and I've been doing more and more live shows. We're working on the music for the next record. There will be a follow-up album to For the Love of Metal, and so thanks. I think that'll be later this year. I know I'm going to be recording vocals in April and May. And again, the outpouring here has been just amazing. Everybody in the community love the record. I'm talking about the musicians themselves. And Jamie says his phone's like blowing off the wall. Everybody wants to get involved and play on the record, be a part of the record. Very flattering. Look, you know, I'm an egomaniac and a narcissist. It's a job requirement for being a front man. It says it on the thing. Are you a narcissist? Yes, I am. Are you an egomaniac? Oh, self-centered? Yes, you could be a front man. But not so much so that I expected this kind of outpouring from the community. It honestly was touching just to see how many people either grew up on Twisted or just like what I was about and wanted to get involved. So it's very cool, and it's great to have new music out in the fucking 2000s when I thought I'd be laying on the beach baking in the sun.
And you just got back from Australia this week or something, didn't you?
Yeah, I was baking in that sun, but that was different. Yeah, we did a couple shows there and got to travel around. It was cool.
Yeah. It's funny because I saw Dee a bunch of times when I grew up in Buffalo, and I think I've only seen you three times in 23 years here in Detroit.
I know. I know. I'm of the shittiest tourer in the world. I don't tour. But I'm doing so many other things that I can't not do my radio career, not do my voiceover career, not do all the other things I'm involved in. So, you know, I mean, I love music, but I love challenges and the fact that I've gotten to do crazy shit like Rock of Ages on Broadway. I was on Broadway for 3 months. That was like bizarro world, man. It was cool as fuck, but it was just a whole different thing, choreography. 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, doing all that shit. So, okay, but do I have one more second?
Yeah.
I'll tell them, okay, this was like, so the weird thing about doing theater is that in rock and roll, you face the audience. You know, you stand on the front of the stage, and you know, and it's like this, right? You know, you're scanning and you're watching. But in theater, it's all this. You know, you're sideways and you're not supposed to acknowledge. You're not supposed to acknowledge the audience. The only acknowledgement is if there's laughter going on, you kind of wait a beat before you do your next line. Other than that, no acknowledgement. So Rock of Ages, great show on Broadway, fucked up movie, terrible movie. Tom Cruise ruined it. And people say, oh, yeah, I thought it was okay. No, let me tell you, I was on Broadway when Cruise came in. And the character of Stacey Jacks was a supporting character. It was a clown character. It was a mixture of Vince Neil, Bret Michaels, David Lee Roth, and Dee Snider all rolled into one. And the guy was a joke. It was a hysterical part. But Cruise came on. He goes, I want him to be more, you know, introverted, more withdrawn. And he turned it into Scott Stapp from Creed. I'm going, who the fuck is that guy? So it was not the character. They rewrote the script for him. So funny show. But my character, I played the bartender, the part Alec Baldwin played. Also, Broadway, no kissing. There was no kissing. There, all of a sudden, I see Russell Brand and Alec Baldwin making out. I go, what the fuck happened? It was like a bromance. It was like two bros, you know? And all of a sudden, they like turned and went to, had to take it the next mile. Fucking Hollywood. So anyway, so I'm on. So my character, at the end, the show ends, and then there's the narrator in Broadway. He just sort of reflects. He goes, well, the club reopened. You know, the band stayed together. Stacey Jacks did this. Unfortunately, we lost Dennis a few years ago. Now, Dennis is the bartender, and I'm still on stage. So at that point, I walk up every night and go, what? And the guy goes, oh, yeah, you're dead. And then I like the spotlight gets smaller and smaller, and I desperately try to stay in the spotlight. And then I walk off into the light off side stage, and I come back as an angel in the end. Okay. Spoiler alert. So, but I'm on stage. So one night I come up and I'm on stage, and he goes, unfortunately, we lost Dennis a few years ago. And I come up on the side. I go, what? He goes, yeah, man, you're dead. And a guy front row right here goes, thank God. It took every fucking thing in my body not to rock out on him and turn around, motherfucker, fuck you. But I just stood my ground. I'm a professional. And I walked off. Afterwards, the dancers told me, we gave him a really dirty look. I said, that was sweet, girls, but somehow not the same as fuck. Anyway, I'm not dead. So
he's still very much alive, guys. Let's hear it for D. Snyder here today at Astronomicon.
There you have it. D. Snyder live from Astronomicon last Friday, the second annual, the third annual coming up again next year. Check out Twisted's website. You can even Google Astronomicon for all the dates. I think it's like February 7th through the 9th or something along those lines in 2020. Real fast, got to thank Twisted's management. George has been so good to me and helped me out with this. Nick running audio, thank you so much. We had a little bit of a problem with some of the audio, but they resent it to me again, and it turned out perfectly. So I really appreciate all the work that you guys did for me, and thank you so much for having me host that with D. Snyder. If you've liked this podcast, you've made it all the way to the end, hey, I think it deserves a 5-star rating. So please, I'd appreciate it if you gave us that 5-star rating, write a review if you get a chance on Apple and iTunes and the whole thing. And of course, share it with your friends. You can leave a voicemail as well for feedback, 248-586-2988. That's 248-586-2988. And as I say every single time, and I do mean it, thank you so much for listening to Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.